The season of fallen soldiers continues. It seems like you can't walk out the door these days without tripping over another one. Just this week, the legendary guitarist Steve Cropper died, and he's rightly being memorialized in all the expected places. At this rate, by the time you hear this, there may very well be another one. If the mid-20th century was the great blooming of American music and musical innovators, then these early decades of the 21st are the winter that inevitably follows, when even the brightest blooms finally freeze. For every musician who gets their flowers, there are countless others who toil in the soil without so much recognition. How do we keep the flame lit after the last gasp leaves the lungs? By listening to the music, sure. But also by saying the names and telling the stories. Musicians bring their art, their craft, but they also bring their humanity. To live a life in music is to surrender a part of your soul to the great celestial symphony, to fill up the cosmic church that connects us all with sound. This is not an insignificant thing. So today, I'm saying the name of one man who could fill up church more than most, and I'm telling the story as I know it. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Phil Upchurch, guitar player, bass player, composer, character, died on November 23rd. The news came 10 days later. Phil was a musician's musician. Those who knew, knew. He played on over 1,000 recordings, everyone from Michael Jackson and Donny Hathaway to Chaka Khan, Jimmy Reed, Curtis Mayfield, George Benson, and the Staple Singers. Producers loved to have him in the studio. Quincy Jones, Tommy LaPuma, Arif Mardin, all worked with him repeatedly. From a musical standpoint, Phil Upchurch was one of those players who you heard 100 times, whether you knew it or not. He belonged to a generation that didn't just contribute to the sound of popular music, they invented it. And like so many of the greatest studio players, he was easy to overlook unless you knew exactly where to focus. But if you did listen, you could always hear him. Phil had that rare gift, the ability to be unmistakably himself while serving the larger story. And I knew Phil for most of my life, too. My relationship with Phil is intertwined with my relationship with my father, Ben. They were friends for over 50 years, recording, touring, sharing life. What you hear behind me is the track Nice to Have You Around from Phil's 1992 Go Jazz Records release, Whatever Happened to the Blues, which was produced by my dad. Some of my first memories of being in a studio involved the two of them together, laughing, experimenting, finding the music in the room. And some of my first gigs as a drummer were with Ben and Phil. Phil treated me with generosity and seriousness, not because I was Ben's kid, but because I was next, the next generation, the next set of hands that might carry something forward. It's easy to romanticize mentorship, but the truth is, it's how the music survives. It's how the names and the sounds persist across time. After Phil's passing, I did what I've done before when a friend leaves the stage. I called my dad. We talked. We remembered. We tried to fill in the hole that was left in the fabric. And in doing so, we performed the small sacred act that keeps a musical life alive. We said the name, Phil Upchurch. Third-story.com is where you can go to visit the archive. Sign up, subscribe. You can also revisit conversations remembering Tommy LaPuma and Richie Cole, or episodes with Clifford Irving, Howard S. Becker, Peter Straub, Al Schmidt, George Wein, Creed Taylor, all of whom delivered their last, or nearly their last, interviews to me for this project. And there are many other deep dives there, too, with session musicians, guitar players, and innovators who shaped the music. Visit the Substack, leosidran.substack.com, for more writing and news. And remember, The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning content. Here's me and Ben Sidran, the day after we learned of Phil Upchurch's passing, telling the story and saying the name. Well, Ben, like so many times before, we are here to remember a friend.
Boy, it's hard. It's hard. We're here to honor Phil Upchurch. And Phil's been in our life for over 50 years. And somebody who's always been there for 50 years suddenly leaves a hole in the fabric of your ongoingness. For years, I mean, we were pals in the recording studio, playing gigs, traveling, carrying on.
Well, let's go back and talk about it. First of all, before you met him, were you aware of him in the 60s? What did you know about him going back?
Well, absolutely. Phil Upchurch in the 60s had a hit song called You Can't Sit Down. And we all knew that. It was this little party song. And then, of course, later on, I found out from Phil that even though the hit was attributed to Phil Upchurch, in fact, he was a sideman in this band. And the band leader had a contract with some other record company or whatever. So he just put Phil's name on it, and it turned into a hit. And the next thing you know, Phil spent his life traveling around playing his hit, which really he kind of snuck in on that one. So, yeah, the name Phil Upchurch was very much out there in the 60s.
Was he even playing on it, though? Did he play the melody on You Can't Sit Down? He just didn't write it.
He's a guitar player. He's a guitar. It's not really a guitar melody kind of tune. It's a groove. It's the break song that the band used to play that got all
the... Can't sit down.
You can't sit down. You can't sit down. It was a big hit. So, yes, we were aware of Phil. I mean, I was listening to, for example, the Staple Singers in 64, 65, and I did not know that Phil Upchurch was playing bass with the Staple Singers.
Wait in the water, whoa. Wait in the water, children. Wait in the water. He's gonna trouble the water. He's gonna trouble the water.
Back then, if you had the record, they never printed the sidemen. They didn't tell you who it was, but Phil was there. Phil was very much a part of the music that we were listening to. He played with Jimmy Reed. I was listening to all those Jimmy Reed tunes with Miller and Boz, and that was Phil. But we only knew his name from the hit, of course.
Well, I'm tired of telling you, baby.
Okay, so this is what you knew about him before you met him. Tell me about that first time that you were introduced to Phil and, you know, what that set in motion for you.
I met Phil in 1972 in a recording studio in L.A. I had gone there as part of a hang with Tommy LaPuma, who was producing a Phil Upchurch record called Darkness, Darkness for his Blue Thumb label. And it was, we went to the studio to hang. And a bunch of cats were there. Harvey Mason was there, the drummer. I just spent the afternoon, and somehow by the end of the afternoon, Phil had asked me to play organ on this tune. Arthur Adams wrote a tune called Love and Peace. Great, great soul tune. I don't know how the conversation got around to me being able to play B3. I had played some organ in the 60s, and so I felt, okay, I'll do it. I didn't go to the session to play. And we locked up. That was in 72. And later that year, I made my own record for Blue Thumb. Of course, Phil, his primary instrument was guitar, but he had such a great feel as a bass player that everybody used him on bass. You know, he worked with Quincy Jones a lot, And I think he played both bass and guitar with Quincy. And in fact, he played on the George Benson hit Breezin'. And I think he played both bass and guitar on the hit song Breezin'.
Huh. Phil is a guy who can find a part. You know, you have to find a part. Here's a track, here's a tune, you never heard it before. We're going to do this right now. Find your part. He was a person who could find a part.
That's what he did. And, you know, the hook on the front of Breezing, that little guitar hook, huge hook. Phil just threw it down at the session.
That's Phil.
That's Phil. Phil was a great session guy. You know, back in the 60s, jazz musicians were really cutting all the hits. The Motown was all jazz musicians playing the Motown hits, and same thing in the New York studios and the LA studios. And Phil was one of these guys, just an all-around gunslinger who would come in on sessions. And he played on everything from Curtis Mayfield. Straight Ahead Jazz Records. And he was living in Chicago.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you about. So you meet him in a studio in LA, but he was for so long so associated with Chicago. And, you know, at some point it must have come up, oh, you live in Chicago, I live in Wisconsin. We're 2 hours away from each other.
Absolutely. Well, when I was making my first record for Blue Thumb, and I had met Phil, and Clyde Stubblefield was in Madison, where I was. And so Phil came up to Madison and spent a week, you know, at the house and we put together a little recording studio. And that first Blue Thumb record was Clyde and Phil on bass and Curly Cook. And I mean, that's a hell of a rhythm section.
And it just because these players fell in your lap, this is the band that you ended up putting together.
Totally. I mean, back then, if you were not recording in New York or LA, there was something wrong with you. Anyway, at that point, I was going in and out of Chicago a lot. And, you know, Phil being the quintessential Chicago musician, meaning that he was a stone cold blues player, a great blues musician, but at the same time, dedicated bebop guitar player. He was more dedicated to inserting 2-5-1 changes into a blues than any musician I ever knew. He had the mind of a bebopper, but the soul of a blues musician. It made him very versatile, but it also made him a bit of an outlier. I mean, one of my favorite Phil Upchurch stories is years later in the 80s when I had the Go Jazz label, and Phil was one of my first artists that I signed. We made a record that was getting a lot of airplay. And I think the song was called Midnight Something or Other. Anyway, it's a great instrumental. And it was starting to get airplay. And back then, radio consultants were becoming very important in radio play. And one of these consultants got back to me and said, well, I like this track a lot. But the fade, there are too many notes on the fade. If you would go in there and edit the fade, we would play this record. We would consider playing this record. I told Phil this. Phil said, they can't do that. I said, well, they can, Phil. They can do whatever they want. If they don't want to play it, they don't have to play it.
It was an injustice that spoke to a reality, though, that he was not afraid to play what he heard.
Not only was he not afraid to play what he heard, but he wanted to play all that jazz on top of grooves and the blues before a lot of other musicians were doing that. You know, a lot of jazz musicians were slumming in rhythm and blues back then, and the blues. Phil was not slumming. Phil was in it 100%. He had the sound. I mean, he was really across. I mean, you could hear B.B. King and what he did. You could hear Kenny Burrell and what he did. You could hear all sorts of the black blues bebop tradition. But the Chicago scene was unique that way. And Phil was really embedded in the scene. I heard Mavis Staples say to Phil's son, I could have been your mama.
That's how embedded he got in the scene.
And from the family root on up.
So the other thing is, you know, you talk about he was a good bass player and a good guitar player. He was also into technology early on, and he had a kind of DIY mentality before that was a term. You know, he figured out how to record himself at home. He loved home recording technology. And, you know, you always talk to me about how he was the first person that you personally knew who was able to record his own demos playing all the instruments.
Absolutely. And I loved them so much. I thought he should have put them out. I thought he should have released his demos. He had such a great feel on drums and bass that when he would do his demos, they felt so great. And in fact, I actually put a song out with him playing drums and Clyde Stubblefield playing bass. It came about at a Chicago recording studio. We were taking a break between tunes, and Phil got behind the drum kit, and Clyde, because he had nowhere else to go, picked up Phil's bass. Clyde couldn't play the bass at all. He played one note on this tune, but the way he played it was so great. And the way Phil played the drums, this song, the title was And Now I Live and Now My Life Is Done, became kind of a hit. It gets a lot of play in Europe. And the drummer was not a drummer, and the bass player was not a bass player. Phil was like the Zelig of the recording studio at one point. He really was, man. You know, after the George Benson hits, Breezing This Masquerade, there were a couple of tunes. Phil's a really good songwriter, and there are a couple tunes that he wrote that were making some money. And, you know, Phil started driving a Jaguar, and he was living the life.
And he was in L.A. He moved to L.A. at some point, obviously.
He moved to L.A., and he was one of the early adapters of this, making all this bread and living high. And I don't know if he said it or if I just picked it up watching it. I realized when things got quiet for him in the recording studios, because everybody has a style, and he had a particular style that as it got into disco, his style was not the primary guitar style, you know. But when it dried up, it dried up.
Yeah.
And it's a lesson that I really shared with a lot of my pals who were making a lot of money and living high. And I said, man, you know, save it. Save your money now. You never know. And Phil had his moments, and then it was hard. In the last 20 plus years of his life, he mostly would play in church. He didn't travel so much anymore, and he wasn't playing gigs so much.
Let me just say a few albums that he was on that you may or may not know that he was on, or you know, you may have forgotten. I mean, he's on Off the Wall, for example. He's also on Donny Hathaway Live. Now, ain't it good to know that you got a friend? People can be so cold. You know that hurt you. Don't try to desert you. Take your soul if you let them. He's on Chaka Khan Records in the late 70s. Jack McDuff Records. Minnie Riperton. Jimmy Smith, he's on like six Jimmy Smith records.
Yep.
I remember you've always said to me exactly that. People are going to have their moment. And just remember, whenever that is, that it's not going to last, that it inevitably, and maybe you get a second one, but it doesn't go on indefinitely. And Phil was the one that sort of modeled that for you, whether or not he wanted to or not.
Yeah.
Obviously, you had been working with him all through the 70s and 80s, but I think that you reconnected. And a couple of years later, you had this label opportunity. And as you say, he was one of the first artists that you signed. And ultimately, you know, Go Jazz Records, when I think about it, and I saw it from the inside and witnessed it from, you know, firsthand. And so it all made perfect sense to me. But it really was almost like the Broadway Danny Rose of a jazz label. It was all of these artists who nobody else would sign.
The one-armed juggler.
Exactly.
And the talking parrots. Yeah, well, I didn't realize it at the time that if I think something is commercial, run.
Yeah, run in the other direction.
But I wanted to make this record for a while called Whatever Happened to the Blues, because the blues exists in so many different genres and idioms in jazz, and it used to be at the heart of all of them, and then gradually it too fell out of favor. And I thought Phil was the perfect person to center this recording on. So Oscar Brown Jr. and Les McCann and Chaka Khan. And I mean, we recorded at Paisley Park, Prince's Studios. And there's a video actually up of a session recording a song called Fade to Black Tie with Ricky and Michael and Upchurch. Actually, my favorite track on that record, and it was a ferocious record with these great musicians, all who had a real part to play in blues music. Phil had written this song. He didn't have a name for it, but he wrote it one night at the hotel where he was staying in Minneapolis, and he came in the next day, and he played it for me, and we were out in the studio. And he said, you know, it doesn't feel right. And he had to take off his shoes so he could pat his feet on the floor of the studio to get the feel. I said that, oh man, that feels great. We got to record this. So we mic'd his feet and his guitar, and we recorded this song. And later I got Pop Staples and Mavis Staples to do a vocal.
Raindrop run through the river. River run to sea, my love run forever. Just the tide keeps a lifting, the tide keeps a lifting me. Been thinking lately, riding this old way. Living ain't that easy. Well, there's the soul that you're trying, the soul that you're trying to save. But it's the time,
oh, it's the time.
Keep a lifting me,
lifting.
The Steels were part of it, and J.D. Steele had written some lyrics. I was on vacation and I came back and Ricky Peterson had produced the half of the session. I mean, it was wild. Go Jazz was definitely an institution run by the inmates.
As I understand it, and I think it's, I don't think it's inappropriate to say this, part of the reason he needed to mic his feet and he said that it didn't feel right is because he had written it in the bathroom of the hotel room where he could hear the slap of his feet on the tile floor. And that was part of it. And we, you know, we all sing in the shower, you know, that there's a, something that echoes in a bathroom that can really inspire. And in this case, The Tide Keeps Lifting Me, which was on his record, and then it also appeared on the soundtrack for the movie Hoop Dreams,
yes,
was written in the hotel bathroom. And in order to get the vibe, he had to mic his feet.
That's some roots music right there, man. You're absolutely right. And that whole thing, you know, about stay close to the inspiration, man. Stay close to the feel. Phil, like you said, was very much interested in the technology of recording. And he, at the same time, loved classical guitar.
He used to play Bach inventions on the guitar, right? He would teach himself how to play Bach on the guitar.
And he would insert jazz harmonies into them, the 2-5-1 series. Anytime he was playing the blues, he was really playing 2-5-1. That's the way he thought, which are harmonic extensions that are bebop inventions, really. So Phil's ability to take hardcore blues and infuse it with this really intellectualized approach, it was unique.
You know, some of the first gigs that I ever played on drums were with Phil playing guitar. He came to Madison and agreed to play with us. It was so generous of him to agree to do that. There were other musicians, friends of yours, who also agreed to do that. And all of them, certainly Phil, seemed to signal that if you were a young person interested in playing this music, that the door was open to you and that you were part of an ongoing legacy and lineage, not because of who your father was, but because you're the next generation. I don't remember him particularly being critical or specific. What I do remember was watching his left foot. I remember sitting behind him and he sat on a chair and we were in a little club the first time I played with him and I just watched his foot and that was the time. He was playing guitar, but the time as he patted his feet on the floor were all you needed to know. And the time was so strong in his foot. He really did treat us, certainly you, like family. When I talked to him a few years ago for your birthday and I asked him to tell me what he remembered about meeting you, he said, "You've been brothers."
Yeah, we were, man.
I remember Tommy LaPuma saying, "You got to check out Ben Sidran. He needs to be on this record." A record that Tommy was producing on me. And that's how he got started. And we've been hanging out pretty tough musically and friend-wise, brothers in love, ever since.
What advice do you have for somebody turning 80 since you've already passed that corner?
Whatever Ben is doing, keep doing it. Because that just makes my heart sing every time I see Ben out there doing it, man. It just makes my heart sing with glee. It really does. And whatever diet you're on, send me a copy. How's Judy?
She's doing great, man. She's got more energy every year that goes by.
Give her my love.
You know, talking about the family connection, your mom was very close to Phil and his multiple wives. He had, I think he was married 5 times. Might have been 4, and he married one of his wives twice. I think that might have happened. But we were very much a part of each other's lives.
We used to have a good time, you know, we used to have a good time with him. He was so cool. He wore knee-high leather boots over skinny jeans, and he had his afro, and he just was good-looking, and in Chicago, in the center of what was going on, and he was experimenting with playing all the parts and making tapes, and it was early on, people weren't doing a lot of that then. It was very innovative and creative, and he was beautiful to look at and watch play. He took us to Benihana's the first time we ever went there. He loved Benihana's. He loved the action, the knives, the Japanese guys. And we went there quite a bit with him. It was before the food scene burst and there were many wonderful options. It was early. Oh, he came when he came to stay at our house, because he came to stay at our house a few times for recording. He always brought his own dimmer switch for the light, where whatever the light was in the room where he was sleeping, he had a dimmer switch to create mood. I just thought it was so cool. And my favorite line of his of all time is, you're playing, I think, at Cafe Montmartre.
Yeah.
And he brought a girl. He had a girlfriend at the time. He was no longer married. I think he was married like five times, but he was in his single phase. And he brought a girl with him, and she decided to go back to the hotel before the gig ended. And he said, okay, but don't start without me. he was just wonderful. he always had something cool to say. He saw Emanuela on the corner as he waiting for a bus, and he drove by and he drove around the block. I think he had a Jaguar, and he drove around the block and wooed her, and they got married, and he brought her to our house, and we were the first white people that she had ever stayed with or even befriended. She was lovely. Oh God, if I think of anything else, I'll tell you.
Those are
That's
great.
Pretty good, isn't it?
Those are really good. Thank you.
Good, you're welcome.
He was a great character, man. A great cat. Very funny, very generous musically. We spent 50 years in and out of each other's lives, houses, studios, sharing not just the music, but whatever we had to share, whatever there was, laughing at the irony of it all and how we got to the point we had gotten to.
So I guess, you know, Phil represents a musician's musician. Those who know. There are plenty of people who heard him and didn't know they heard him. And then there are plenty of people who didn't hear him. And that's a shame too. On the other hand, he represented the great success of the studio player. What is the takeaway? This is a kind of cat who won't exist again, won't come along again. What do we make of Phil's life?
Well, you know, on the one hand, he had a little too much to offer the recording scene. His music, even when he was playing a simple song, was not simple. His improvisations were complicated. He didn't go for the cheap tricks. He didn't go for the guitar effects. He went for the great notes, the hip notes. He was very much a self-invented musician. And so his music was who he was, and he was standing behind that, and he didn't sell that out. And so it made him less, in a way, popular than maybe a lot of other players who didn't have his focus or his gifts. But that's not an uncommon story. Phil was somebody who, as I say, was self-invented, who grew up with one foot in the church and one foot, you know, on the corner. He really scaled the top of the mountain during his time. And we all have a time. He lived a very complete life. In a way, he represented a truth rather than a fiction.
When you think about making a record like Whatever Happened to the Blues, everybody that you called said yes, if it was for Phil.
Yeah.
And I think they probably appreciated that somebody was saying Phil's name at that time. When you really take it all in the accounting, the final accounting, that may be the greatest legacy. The musicians love you and that your peers love you.
I like that. The takeaway, what is the takeaway of Phil's life? That nothing's more important than your reputation. Really, that's all you're left with in the end. The money goes, everything goes, but your reputation lives on. People who knew and they're still on the planet, they know. And people throw around the term legendary, but I mean, you go from Jimmy Reed to Michael Jackson, that's pretty unusual, man.
Yes, and, you know, to put a little personal point on it, when I think back on that first gig that I played where he took me seriously as a musician, it gave me a way to carry on his legacy now and to, you know, to whatever that means, and to say his name, and that there are people that will keep talking about him after he's gone. And that is how you live on.
Yeah. Well, we're really at that crisis point in the jazz business. Now it's more and more difficult to have that kind of an education where somebody puts his hand on your shoulder and says, yeah, I hear you. I hear you. I hear your intention. And I want to encourage you to be you. Phil was him. Phil wasn't trying to sound like anybody. Be you. Do you do you. And man, what a privilege to hang with Phil. And especially that period when it was with Clyde, it was so easy to play with them. What they play often could sound very complex, but there was something very focused and simple about it that let you know there was room for you to come on in there and find yourself.
All right, Ben, thank you for sharing yet again your memories.
Thank you, Leo.
Of another lost fallen soldier.
Yes, we leave them where they lay, man. We leave them where they lay. Thank you, man.
There it was, my friends, remembering Phil Upchurch. Let me leave you with one last story. When I was 18 years old, a freshman at the University of Wisconsin, my dad called me and told me to meet him at Smart Studios in Madison, where he was making his album Mr. P's Shuffle. When I got there, Phil Upchurch and bassist Richard Davis were already in the room. Clyde Stubblefield had been playing drums on most of the album, but I was invited to play on this one tune, A Light Little Blues. I was careful not to play too much. I just kept a sparse little shuffle going. James Farber, the great New York engineer and former Third Story guest, eventually mixed that record, and he later teased me that I didn't even play the bass drum one time. And I'm not surprised. I was being very cautious. I didn't want to play too much. But Ben and Richard and Phil were generous and encouraging, as they always were. And I can think of no better way to close out today than to revisit that track, which conveniently, though somehow not surprisingly, is called Memory Lane. I'll be back in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.